Okay, here we are again. This is Didactic Mind, episode 27, Red versus Blue. Very warm welcome, as always, to my loyal readers and listeners, my SoundCloud subscribers, and if you're listening to this for the first time, if you are listening to the dulcet tones of the Didact for the very first time, then I strongly encourage you to subscribe so that you never ever miss a new upload of these most excellent podcasts. I am, of course, your host, the Didact. You have to forgive me if I sound a little croaky. I am not sick with the Kung Flu. Nobody worry, I'm doing just fine. It's just that the air is a bit dry around here for various reasons, and as a result of spring weather and, you know, pollen and particulates in the air, combined with very, very dry air, my nasal passages seem to be a bit irritated and congested due to all of this. But nothing to worry about. I'm just sitting here with a cup of tea, and my voice may be a little croakier than usual, but we'll get through it, as we do with everything else. So, I am, of course, as I said, the Didact. And this is my weekly podcast in which I go over topics of the day, ideas, things of interest to me, problems that we're facing in the world, and kind of give my own spin on them. Again, for those of you who aren't familiar with my work, for those of you who are, you know what's coming. The topic of this week's discussion is red versus blue. Now, this isn't just because I'm a giant Halo nerd. For those of you who remember the old web-based series Red vs. Blue, it's all there on Netflix, I think. Yeah, or it was, at least when I was in the States. It was on Netflix, you know, I think 8 seasons worth of Red vs. Blue. And what was Red vs. Blue? It was this weird animated series made using Halo screen captures, where they started off with the original Halo Combat Evolved multiplayer, and they went from there. I mean, they started using Halo 2, Halo 3, eventually Halo 4, and so on. And it was two teams of Red Spartans and Blue Spartans, and they were fighting each other, and they had no idea why they were fighting, really. They didn't have a clue. But they, the web series, I mean, I never really cottoned onto it. I prefer my Halo full of explosions and fights against the Flood and the Covenant. I don't really care much for the exposition of rival teams slagging each other. That's not the point. The point of Halo is action and epic storytelling. But the point of Red versus Blue as the intro here is that it's useful to compare the responses between what you might call red states in the USA versus blue states. Red states being Republican-controlled or primarily conservative, however you want to think of it, and blue states being primarily Democrat-controlled or predominantly liberal, again, however you might want to think of it. And I touched on this in yesterday's post about how liberty dies, where I posted up videos from two different Fox News personalities, the ever-based Tucker Carlson, for whom I have great respect. I think he's one of the very, 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 very few media personalities that actually has a clue as to what's going on in America, and who actually understands the struggles and the issues of the common man. And Laura Ingraham, who is another one of those more sensible types. I mean, she's made a few mistakes in her career, and she's miscalculated a few times, and that's fine. I mean, you can't expect media types to get it right all the time. They're always going to make a few missteps here and there. But overall, I think she's been one of the better voices, one of the saner voices, when it comes to the Kung Flu in particular, and the general culture in a broader sense. Both of these people had various charts and graphs showing the responses by state and local authorities to the chink flu and made it very clear just how big the divide is between different groups or different ideologies in the USA. Now, the background to all of this has to be seen through the lens of another book that I just finished reading, and it's one of my favorite books ever. It's called The Last Centurion by John Ringo. Now, I've talked about this book a number of times. I've written about it a number of times on my blog. It is eerie. It is creepy. Deeply unsettling how prophetic this book was. This was a book written back in 2009, basically right after the election of President Obama, the light worker, President O'Dumbass, as I call him, because he was such a disaster. And, the only good thing about Obama, if there was anything good about such an incompetent, useless, feckless, gormless, hopelessly inept character as Obama, is that he spent quite a lot of his time on the golf course. And may, because I don't know, I don't want to get sued, may have spent quite a bit of his time high. I don't know. I'm just saying that's what it looked like. I'm not suggesting that he was. I'm just saying there have been some rumors out there that that's what he was doing. That's all I'm saying, all right? Judge for yourself based on the evidence. But the only reason he wasn't a worse president, which is astonishing if you think about it, given what a colossal disaster he was, is because he was in absentia most of the time. Where he really needed to be in the office doing stuff, he was basically not doing stuff. And thank God for that. But anyway, John Ringo wrote this book in the backdrop of the election of President Obama. And I believe this was shortly before or around the time that swine flu started showing up. H1N1. The Last Centurion, when was this? Yeah, The Last Centurion was published August 25th, 2009, by Bain Books. August 25th, 2009. Interesting how that timing works out. Look at it this way. A very liberal president had just been elected. The country was going through a massive economic crisis. Swine flu was making the rounds, and contrary to what the lying hornlists of the mainstream, quote-unquote, media would like you to believe, the Obama administration's response to the swine flu was not quick. It was not prompt. I know, because there are people who read my blog and who I correspond with on a regular basis who have told me that the CDC, under Obama's basically lack of direction, dithered for about 6 weeks before actually doing anything to issue any guidelines. So there was a major flu pandemic, and oddly enough, this one didn't come from China. It's one of the few pandemics that hasn't come from China, actually. This pandemic originated in Central America and spread to the US and then to China, and killed quite a few Asians, killed quite a lot of Asian children, in fact. So it was in this context that John Ringo wrote his book, and he projected forward about 6-7 years in the future. And he came up with a world in which a very, very liberal, crazy, evil woman was elected president, is elected president, and becomes the 45th president of the United States. And President Warwick in the book is just a very thinly veiled stand-in for Hillary Clinton, Hillary the Hildebitch. The thought of someone that mendacious, that evil, that I don't even know how to describe her other than as truly wicked. Someone like that, the thought of that as president is just horrifying. Thank God. I mean, we dodged the whole world, not just America, but the whole world dodged a nuke. a gigaton yield nuke aimed directly at the heart of all that is good, beautiful, and true when President Trump was elected. When, I should say, his most illustrious, noble, august, benevolent, and legendary celestial majesty, the God Emperor of mankind, Donaldus Triumphus Magnus Astra, the first of his name, may the Lord bless him and preserve him, was elected as the 45th president. Thank God that happened, because if Hillary was president at this time, I mean, John Ringo's predictions would have been 100% accurate. Not, you know, 80% accurate, but 100% accurate. So, what did Ringo predict in his book? Well, this crazy woman, President Warwick, is elected in 2016, and a major plague escapes out of China in 2018-19 time frame. And it's not coronavirus, it's not Corona-chan, it's not the Kung Flu, it's actually human transmissible H5N1, more commonly known as bird flu. And bird flu starts hitting the world, and with its 60% mortality rates, kills off huge numbers of people around the world. I mean, Corona-chan has killed, officially, what's the death toll from Corona-chan? The official global death toll from Corona-chan is supposedly 244,000 people. Well, that's, you know, a drop in the bucket, actually. I believe that estimate to be a minimum of 30% too high. I think the actual number of Kung Flu-related deaths is closer to about 200,000. Now, again, that's before you get to the fact that the Chinese have just lied their asses off about the numbers. The Iranians have lied their asses off. There is absolutely no reason to trust the numbers from either country. So I don't believe that they are, I believe they have massively undercounted their victims. I believe the USA has massively overcounted its victims. I believe that, I know that India is dramatically undercounting its victims because there is tremendous pressure on doctors not to put the Kung Flu as the cause of death to avoid sparking panic in India. So you can't trust any of these numbers from anywhere. So even so, 200,000, 250,000, 300,000, whatever. Not to be callous and not to be heartless, but that's a drop in the piss bucket compared to the true mortality numbers that would result from something like H5N1 becoming human transmissible, easily human transmissible, and escaping from China, which it will do because of the way that the Chinese handle their poultry and the way that the just abominable safety practices that they have, and the fact that China is a totally low-trust, high-performance society, it's going to happen. We know that the next plague is going to come from China. So this plague escapes and ravages the world, and some parts of the world fare better than others because there's a kind of a MacGuffin embedded in the story where there's a vaccine for H5N1. There is a type 1 vaccine and a type 2 vaccine. The type 1 vaccine only describes the coat proteins of H5N1 and prevents it from lodging or, you know, getting, infecting the binding sites in the lungs where people are most susceptible, but it's ineffective in the face of mutated biological strains of this virus. And then there's the type 2 vaccine, which describes the coat proteins of all influenza viruses. And the USA does a mixed job of distributing type 2 vaccine. And, you know, there's all sorts of other stuff going on in the book where John Ringo talks about what a scam global warming is, anthropogenic global warming, and how a very liberal administration leads the country down the road to disaster. But, there's so much good stuff in the book. There's so much red meat in the book that you can talk about for hours and hours. Because there's so many great ideas presented in the book. And honestly, I mean, I would love to be able to talk to Mr. Ringo about this. I would love to be able to interview him and put the interview up as a podcast. But you know what? That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to see if I can reach out to John Ringo. He's probably going to tell me to F off, but what the hell? Nothing ventured, nothing gained. And I'm going to try to set up an interview with him where I can talk about The Last Centurion, because it's been like 10 years since that book was released, and I'd love to get his thoughts about how things have turned out since then with the Kung Flu, with everything that's happened. I would love to know what he thinks. I want to talk to him about some of the other things that he's done, such as the Legacy of the Old Inata series, which is, you know, it's on hiatus, basically, and has been for longer than 10 years, like 15 years now. And the Troy Rising series, which ended on a cliffhanger after book 3, and some of the other stuff that he's done. So I would love to be able to talk to him about these things. I'm going to try to do that. That's my challenge for myself. So in the book, in The Last Centurion, towards the end of the book, there is some really interesting stuff about how the Red States versus at the beginning of the book and the end of the book, there are some really interesting points made about how Red States versus Blue States handle the fallout of a major natural disaster, a plague that ruins the economy, destroys families, and wipes out entire neighborhoods and entire communities. So it's instructive to look at that in the current context. If you look at the USA, and if you look around the world, actually, at various countries, which are the countries that have had the most effective responses to the Kung Flu? Or the states which have had the most effective responses? Well, at first glance, it's a completely mixed bag. I mean, you can't say what the common traits are, because if you look at Japan, Japan had a highly effective response using one particular set of methods. Singapore had a highly effective response using a very completely opposite set of methods. China, forget China, don't believe a damn thing the Chinese say. You can't trust them. You can't trust the people. You can't trust the government. Just don't bother. Okay, so don't even bother with the Chinese. They're a lost cause. I mean, there's a lot of things to admire about their culture. There's a lot of things to admire about them as people. But their trustworthiness is not one of those things. And their outright racism is astonishing. I mean, they are easily the most racist people I've ever seen. So don't believe anything that they have to say. They cannot be trusted and they cannot be respected. At least in this regard, for their handling of the Kung Flu and its after effects. So you can't listen to anything the Chinese say. Don't listen to much that India says, because the Indian government has this really weird sort of ready fire aim approach to doing things, where the central government will just come up with a policy and say, this is the policy. And then a week later we'll be like, oh, whoops. Yeah, we didn't see that coming. They'll think through the consequences later, and that's exactly what happened. I mean, they basically shut down the entire country for 21 days without ever thinking how to implement it and what would happen. And it was just idiotic what happened. So don't trust anything the Indians say. Don't trust anything that the Africans say or the Arabs say. You can't trust these people. They are low trust cultures. Then you move on to Europe, where you have high trust cultures in general, not completely, but in general you have high trust cultures. And you look at the situation in Europe, and it's all over the map. You have countries like Italy and Spain, which are complete disasters. And you have countries like Sweden and Norway, which have diametrically opposed approaches to dealing with the Kung Flu, but have had similar outcomes. And you look at France and Germany, again, similar approaches in the sense of very authoritarian lockdowns and clampdowns, but radically different results. You look at the USA, you look in between various states, you look at the federal response, you look at the state responses. At every level, there is confusion and there is misdirection, there is miscommunication, but It's all a complete mess. You can't really sort it out until you start looking at things through the lens of trust. Trust is a big thing in Ringo's book, and with good reason. I've written about societal trust many, many, many times on my blog for the last 7.5 years, because it's a critical component of understanding how cultures work or don't work. The hallmark of high-achieving cultures, genuinely high-achieving cultures that create world-spanning empires and that really leave their mark on societies well outside of their own, is trust. Cultures that achieve great things are generally high-trust cultures. In this respect, China, for instance, has not been anything like the achiever that it could have been. Let's be as fair as possible to China and the Chinese. On the international stage, China has been much more sinned against than sinner for the last several hundred years. That's a fact, okay? China has, on balance, been a relatively neutral, relatively benign. I say relatively, I'm not excusing anything that they do. Relatively benign power for much of the last 500 or so years. Maybe for the last 1,000 years, actually, if you look at its history. The reason for this is not because China is a high-trust culture. It's not. The Chinese do not have the same level of understanding of social trust as Westerners do. If you look at the Confucian ethic, the Confucian ethic basically preaches trust for authority, not trust for each other. You respect your family members, your elders, you respect authority, but you don't necessarily respect each other. I mean, that's, you know, I'm bastardizing the Confucian ethic quite badly here, but the idea of respect for your neighbors, of loving your neighbor as you love yourself, is not common to Chinese thinking, and it never has been, and it probably never will be. But if you look at what China actually achieved on the world stage, China hasn't done anything like what it could have with its economy, its technical knowledge, its education system, and various other advantages that it had. I mean, in the 14th century, China was the world's most advanced power by far, at a time when when Europe was mired in the depths of a catastrophe known as the Black Death, and was dealing with the economic consequences of a plague that had wiped out about a quarter of its population. Probably more, in fact. So the Chinese had everything at their disposal, but they stagnated, they ossified. Why is that? And why is it that European powers came along later on and ate their lunches? Why is it that China became basically a plaything of European powers? The answer to that is that these cultures which came along later are high-trust cultures. High-trust, high-performance cultures. So when you look at things on the axes of respect for authority and social trust, now all of a sudden the world becomes a much clearer place. And particularly when you apply that paradigm to the Kung Flu. If you look at the countries that have handled the outbreaks well, if you have, let's say, on the x-axis, high social trust, you know, do people treat their neighbors like they treat themselves? Do they respect each other? Do they get along well with each other? From low trust on the left side to high trust on the right side, okay? That's your x-axis. On your y-axis, you have respect for authority. You have low trust for authority on the negative end of the scale or on the bottom end. And on the top end of the scale, you have high degree of respect for authority. Which nations have done well? Okay. The nations that have done well, or the nations that have done better than average in terms of dealing with the Kung Flu, typically fall into the right side of this scatter plot. Japan is a very high trust, high respect culture. Okay? Japan has done exceptionally well. How did the Japanese handle the Kung Flu? They handled it by basically telling everybody, stay indoors, stay away from other people, just, you know, observe some basic social distancing guidelines and, you know, keep to yourselves. The Japanese came out of it with very few deaths, almost none, and relatively speaking, despite the fact that the Japanese have the world's oldest population. So, if you look at Taiwan, what happened to them? the Taiwanese implemented some pretty draconian quarantine measures, but only for the sick. And they implemented some very, very strong surveillance techniques and protocols, which in the West, up until fairly recently at least, people would have found horrifying. But it worked. Taiwan has very few deaths relative to its population. If you look at Taiwan, you know, six deaths out of 432 cases. That's unbelievable, considering it's, you know, 120 miles off the coast of China. That is incredible that they've managed to do that. And they've managed it simply by observing some very basic common sense practices. Japan, what happened with Japan? In Japan, 517 fatal cases out of 15,000 total, right? Again, they did an amazing job. South Korea, if you look at South Korea, they have a similarly benign situation. 250 deaths out of 11,000 cases. That's, I mean, it's incredible. They did an amazing job in keeping all of this under control. Why? Primarily because they are a high-trust, high-respect society. Respect meaning respect for authority. If you look at Singapore, on the other hand, what happened? I mean, Singapore is kind of an outlier. Singapore is a low-trust, high-respect society. Why do I say Singapore is low-trust? Because the only reason, or the major reason, why Singaporeans keep in line is not because they like each other. They don't. Singapore is 70% Chinese and 20% 20+% Malay, and the remainder is a mix of Indian and foreign admixtures. That's not a healthy recipe for a society. If you have predominantly Chinese mixed in with other cultures, it's not going to work very well for the other cultures, and it's not going to work particularly well for the Chinese either. It's a low-trust society. People don't steal stuff not because they don't want to steal stuff. People don't steal stuff because they know that they're on camera all the time. Okay, I'm not saying Singaporeans are bad people, because they're not. I actually like Singapore a lot. I would much rather be in Singapore than in just about any other part of Asia, including China or Japan. I would much rather be in Singapore. But Singapore is not a high-trust society once the cameras are off. Okay, what happened in Singapore? You know, 18,000 cases, 17 deaths. I mean, 0.1% fatality rate, mortality rate. That's before you get to the fact that the Kung Flu is nowhere near as deadly as everyone thinks it is. So, if you go to Europe, what do you see? The societies where you have the most fatalities, you know, France, Italy, obviously is a disaster. Spain, where else? All across the sort of what you might call the Mediterranean countries, there have been large numbers of fatalities and little social trust. France is a battle zone. You know, with the yellow vests have never suspended their protests against the government, and the government is pretty much daily losing respect in the eyes of the citizens, as it should, because, as with most things, I mean, France is has a very corrupt, entrenched elite, as with most countries. If you look at Italy, I mean, Italy is the poster child for low social trust, or I should say low respect for authority, and relatively high social trust. So, with Europe, you know, you're seeing countries where respect for authority is very low and social trust is eroded in the most multicultural areas. And they're all falling on the left side and the lower left quadrant of that graph that I outlined. You know, keep that graph in mind, because it's going to be important for when we get to the US. If you look at Great Britain, again, if you look at Britain regionally, there are huge variations. There are some parts of Britain which have almost no effect from the Kung Flu. Those tend to be the high trust, high respect parts of the UK. If you look at London, on the other hand, complete disaster zone. And this goes beyond merely the fact that big cities are breeders for nasty bugs and viruses. London is, you know, ground zero in Britain, and it is a disaster. But even in London, there are some areas which have had no deaths from the Kung Flu. Three, I think, which have had no fatalities. London is a classic example of a low-trust, low-respect metropolis. People don't respect, particularly in the more, let's say, diverse areas of London, people have no respect for government authority. They only respect their local leaders, their local, to be very blunt, imams, because that's what it's like in London these days. They don't respect the British government at all. The people who respect the British government are predominantly the old Londoners, the old actual English people. But London is not an English city anymore and hasn't been for a long time. I was in London last August, late last August, actually very early September. It didn't look like London to me. It didn't look like a British city to me. Everybody that I met was a foreigner, pretty much. I stayed in an Airbnb apartment that was run by a Hungarian couple. A lovely couple. I mean, they were just very nice people. But they were Hungarians. They weren't English. Every restaurant I went to, the staff were foreigners. Every place that I saw, run by foreigners. The parts of London that I spent a lot of time in, run by foreigners. Full of foreigners. The skyline didn't look like it was London. It was a classic example of what you might call a blue state in the US. And the way that London has evolved is very, during this whole crisis, is very indicative of the way that the blue states have evolved. If you look at the videos coming out of London, you see very heavy-handed authoritarian reactions, overreactions to the whole situation, where they're basically, you know, the police are basically telling them, get back in your house, get away from me, you're killing people by being outside. Guys, relax. The evidence is clear. The Kung Flu is not nearly as dangerous as everyone thinks it is, and while it is highly infectious, it's not as infectious as measles. It's not as dangerous as you think. Everybody, chill out. But no, they're not doing that. They're high on authority right now. So let's go across the pond. Or actually, before we do that, let's talk about Sweden and Norway. Sweden, very large number of cases relative to Norway, okay? If you look at Sweden right now, about 22,000 cases and 2,700 deaths, roughly speaking. If you look at Norway, 7,800 cases, 211 deaths. Okay, Sweden didn't implement a full lockdown. Norway did. How do you explain the differences in death rates? Well, for one thing, Sweden's population is significantly different than that of Norway. Sweden has, 10 million people in it, roughly speaking, as of 2017. So it's probably 10.5 million now. If you look at Norway, Norway has a much smaller population, I believe. Yeah, half the population. 5.3 million, thereabouts. So if you look at the comparative statistics, if you look at it on a per capita basis, Sweden and Norway aren't all that different, but their responses are dramatically different, and yet their cultures are basically the same. High trust, high authority, high respect, right? They respect government and spiritual authority very much in these two countries. And yet, very similar outcomes, despite the lockdowns. What gives? Well, that leads to another explanation about, or another reality of the Kung Flu, which I hope to get to towards the end of all of this. But now let's jump across the pond, across the Atlantic to the USA, and let's look at the very, very different responses between different American states. If you look at what you would call the blue states, Democrat run, and you know, let's put aside the fact that the colors switched. The media pulled a major bait and switch on people back in, I think, the early 90s, where they changed the colors for Democrat from red to blue, and they changed the colors from Republicans from blue to red. Why is this? I'm pretty sure it was a psychop. It was a psyop, for sure. Red, of course, is, in the human mind, is bad. Blue is good. Okay? The media deliberately did this to show their allegiance with the Democrats. That's been the case for a very long time. So don't fool yourself into thinking that red states were always red in terms of color. They actually used to be blue. If you look at videos of President Reagan's, you know, St. Reagan Magnus of the right, if you look at his crushing electoral victory over Walter Mondale in 1984, you will see that all of the states that went for Reagan were colored in blue on the map. And all this, and the one state that went for Mondale, which was his home state, was colored red. Okay. Be aware of this. This is important for the way in which the media lies to you, and just be aware of that fact. But if you look at the various states and the way they operate, you know, the states that are hardcore blue, Michigan, California, Washington, Nevada to some respect, to some extent, New Mexico for sure, New York of course, New Jersey definitely, Massachusetts, where else? Minnesota. They've enacted extremely foolishly stringent lockdown measures, and they're basically telling their people, no, you can't go back to work, you can't do anything, we're not gonna, you have to stay locked down until end of May. Illinois just basically said that. Illinois said, no, you can't do anything until end of May. If they want more control, they want more power. It's a naked power grab for these states. But if you look at the red states, if you look at the Republican-controlled states, by and large, and this is not universally true, but by and large, they want to get back to work. They want to get back to business. Why is that? Look at Florida. Look at Texas, look at Louisiana, Arkansas, Oklahoma, Arizona, which is still a red state, but is, you know, rapidly becoming blue because of the immigrants, the never-to-be-sufficiently cursed immigrants coming in from California, Commifornia, bastards turning Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas rapidly blue, the assholes. They really should just be banned from voting for 20 years after they arrive. I mean, that should be a universal rule in the U.S. You should not be allowed to vote for 20 years if you move states until you actually have roots and skin in the game. Until then, no, shouldn't be allowed to vote. But anyway, you know, Montana, Wyoming, basically have no cases in either of these states, and they're doing just fine. Idaho, you know, what? 2,000 cases and 64 deaths. I mean, come on, like, there's no point in keeping things closed. Utah, 4,800 cases, 46 deaths. Like, come on, guys. I mean, it's nowhere near justified to keep things closed. These states, the red states, are itching to get back open, and they're basically treating their people with like more or less like adults. They're basically saying, okay, if you need to get out, you need to go shop and go to a restaurant, fine, just be a bit careful. They're generally treating people like adults, even though if you look at Texas or you look at Florida, these are pretty diverse states. I mean, in terms of racial and cultural diversity, there's a lot of that going on in these two states. But they're treating people like adults. Why is that? Again, it comes down to social trust. If you've ever lived in New York effing city, and I have, or in New Jersey, and I have, you will know that social trust is very low in these places. And again, it varies depending on the neighborhood you're in. I mean, I lived in a very nice neighborhood in Jersey City. I lived in two very nice neighborhoods, actually, when I was living in Jersey City. Wonderful place. I loved it there. I mean, it was just fantastic to live in those neighborhoods. It was, the cost of living was much lower than in NYFC. The commute was great. I had really nice apartments and good lifestyle. I loved being in that part of town. But if you just drive a mile or two down the road, you come to Jersey City Heights. Now, that is not a nice part of town, and you don't want to be in it. So social trust in that part of town was extremely low. Social trust in the nice part of town was relatively high. The places that have responded well to the plague have been the places with high social trust. And this is a finding that we're seeing repeated around the world. Places that have adapted, reacted, and overcome, exactly as John Ringo predicted in his book, are places with high social trust. And this is a lesson that we must remember into the future. Places where people don't trust each other are places that are going to fall apart fast in the event of severe economic or sort of contemporary stress in the face of severe challenges. These are the places that are going to fall apart very quickly, and these are the places where the instinctive reaction of the leadership and the people will be to turn to authoritarianism, to resort to extreme violations of basic liberties. That's exactly what has happened in Canada. The Canadians are becoming an ever more diverse bunch of people. The Canadians have a fatal addiction to the magic dirt drug. The magic dirt illusion. They've been running a massive immigration program for years, where they just bring in anybody who meets their qualification requirements, and once those people get there, they're automatically considered Canadian. Well, they're not Canadian. They don't share anything in common with Canadian culture. And their Prime Minister Justin Bieber, or Justin Trudeau, or Justin Bieber, whatever you want to call him, he basically implemented a sweeping gun control measure in the wake of a mass shooting where 22 people were killed. And he did it, he justified it by saying, this is long overdue and we need gun control. It's like, dude, firstly, 7 out of those 22 people died in fires that had nothing to do with guns. I mean, they died because of fire, actual, you know, being burned alive. And that's horrible. It's the worst way to die. But it wasn't a gun that killed them. So you're going to outlaw fire as well? I mean, good luck with that. And second, the guy who committed the mass shootings got his guns illegally from the USA and brought them over the border. So what you're doing is, you know, confiscating guns from people who have a right to defend themselves, but you're doing nothing about people who actually are going to cause harm. I mean, it's the same old story around the world, whether it's in New Zealand or Australia or Canada or, of course, in America or in the UK, anywhere else. It's always the law-abiding who get hurt by these authoritarian overreaches. And it's always the criminals who benefit. It's always those who prey on the weak who benefit. And there's a very, very much a blue state mentality. Something goes wrong, you look to the government to solve the problem. That's not how it works. Whereas if you look at the red state mentality is something goes wrong, it's up to us to fix it. It's up to me and my neighbors and my family and the people that I trust to fix it. If you look at the reactions to Kung Flu worldwide, as I said, the reactions that seem to have worked the best are those in high respect, high trust zones. There are outliers where you have high respect, low trust societies that have responded well, and there are outliers where you have low trust, high respect. Well, actually, no, that's not true. The major example of a low trust, high respect society is China. That's a terrible example. Another good one another bad one is India. And India is not a high respect, low trust society. It's a low respect, low trust society. So forget that. As a general rule, the countries that have responded well are high respect, high trust. Okay. The USA is among those countries, but there are significant regional variations in that sort of characterization. My friend and longtime reader and supporter of the blog, The Male Brain, who lives in Israel, wrote in on a comment and pointed out that Israel is what he would call a medium trust, medium respect society, and Israel has responded quite well, which is to be expected. I'm not surprised about that. Overall, what you're looking at is what the picture that is emerging is that the states and the countries which have responded well are the ones where there is a combination of high respect for authority, or at least medium respect for authority, and high social trust, high social cohesion. The countries where that has not been the case have responded extremely badly. Now we get to the subject of lockdowns. Did lockdowns work? Well, the evidence is increasingly clear that it did not. They did not work. It doesn't matter whether you're looking in New York City, it doesn't matter whether you're looking in London, it doesn't matter whether you're looking in Texas or Arkansas or California or any of the other places, it doesn't matter whether you're looking at Sweden or Norway, it's becoming absolutely inescapable that lockdowns did not work. The virus in London peaked on around 8th of April. This was weeks before the government-mandated shutdowns could possibly have had the effect that people claimed. The lag time between a complete shutdown of government, of the economy, and of movement within, among people, would have taken root or been effective. Between like actually being mandated and actually being effective is about 1 month, because that's how long it takes for all of this to work itself out. So the government did not mandate a shutdown on March 8th. They mandated a shutdown like 2-3 weeks later. All of April came and went. The virus peaked in the UK on April 8th. Ever since then, there has been a decline in new infections. There has been a decline in the death rate. There is no valid reason whatsoever to keep the lockdown in place, but the government insists on doing it. Why? Because it doesn't trust its own citizens, and its citizens don't trust it. If you look at the US, the virus has very definitively peaked in most American states at this point. At no point was the American healthcare system in any danger of collapse. New York effing city thought that they would need 40,000 ventilators across the whole city and the whole state to avoid a complete collapse of the system. The God Emperor, blessed be his name, said, you're probably not going to need 40,000 ventilators. And he was right. Governor Andrew Cuomo, who before this crisis was basically, a caricature of a mafia thug, and during this crisis has somehow been transformed into a highly competent, highly wise, benevolent Democrat hero. He's not absolutely nothing of the sort. He is every bit as corrupt and sleazy and dirty as any other politician you can think of. He said, we're going to need 40,000 ventilators. This is going to be a terrible crisis, and I'm not sure we're even going to be able to get through it properly. This is going to be a massive emergency. Well, the God Emperor diverted a hospital ship to New York. That hospital ship had a total of 9 patients. It was converted at great expense into a highly secure kind of biohazard level facility dealing with hazardous pathogens. And that was an expensive conversion. 9 people used that ship. They didn't need so many ventilators. I mean, it got to the point where New York was basically giving its ventilators away to places like Maryland. The same applied in California. The God Emperor was extremely responsive, got things done, made things happen. There was a hospital ship docked in, I think, Los Angeles. I could be wrong about that. It received very, very few patients. It has like 1,000 beds, and it received very few patients. The virus has peaked. It's run its course. It's done. It's not going to kill all that many more people. I mean, it's going to kill quite a few more, yes, but it's not going to kill hundreds of thousands. It never did kill hundreds of thousands. The mortality numbers coming out of the U.S. are vastly overinflated, and we know this. There was that excellent hour-long presentation by the two urgent care doctors, Erickson and Masihi, which I have posted on my blog. It's also on my BitChute channel. It's the only video on my BitChute channel because, of course, the benevolent tech overlords at YouTube decided to censor their video because it said things that were not in line with what the CDC and the WHO preach. Which just goes to show you how corrupt YouTube is. But you knew that already. And it says, you know, the results of their analysis, of the analyses of these two doctors and what they were hearing from their colleagues, showed very clearly that this virus is nowhere near as contagious as anyone thinks it is. It's nowhere near as deadly. There are lots and lots of cases and very few deaths. The number of infected is not what is officially being reported. It's anywhere from 5 to 10 times that amount. So if you look at, you know, the U.S. statistics right now, if you look at the USA, there are 1.16 million people infected with the Kung Flu right now, or who have had the infection. That number is at least 5 times too small. At least. The actual number is anywhere from 5 to 10 times that amount. So anywhere from 6 to 12 million people were infected with the Kung Flu, which suddenly makes this 67,000 dead nowhere near as terrifying as we thought. 67,000 dead, I remind you, is probably about 30% too high. So the actual death rate is more like 50,000 dead from the Kung Flu. I reckon even that's probably too high. But anyway, let's take 50,000 as the baseline of deaths from Kung Flu. Divide that by 6 million rather than 1 million. This becomes no worse than a seasonal flu, like a bad seasonal flu. Divide it by 12 million. It's a rounding error. I mean, I'm sorry. I'm genuinely sorry for those who died. I'm very sorry for their families. No one should have to go through that agony. But the reality is, this virus isn't that dangerous. And yet, the blue states are locking down and continuing their abuses of power. Why? Because they don't trust their people, and their people don't trust them. If you look at the red states, by and large, the red states are nowhere near this crazy. They're nowhere near as diverse, obviously. And the people there trust each other. They trust their communities. They trust their government, more or less. I mean, you know, if you talk to Texans, I'm pretty sure they'll look at Austin as a city that's ripe for carpet bombing, except for the state capitol, which is a beautiful building, by the way. I went to Austin in early 2017 to visit a friend of mine, and I loved the place. I thought it was fantastic. But I understand why people want to bomb it. I mean, I understand why Texans don't like it. Like, hardcore Texans don't like Austin. I get it, right? I get that. I'm with you on this. But Texas as a place is a remarkable state. I mean, it's basically its own country with its own culture. But it's a remarkable place because the people there are very self-sufficient, and they believe in being self-sufficient. I remember going for a drive down the Texas, I think it was the I-87. Let me check that. I was driving from Austin to San Antonio to visit another friend of mine. And I basically drove all the way down, and it was a beautiful, really beautiful drive. I had a lot of fun going out there, and it was the I-35. I took the I-35 all the way down to Austin, and to San Antonio, and it was just a fantastic drive. And all along the freeway, along the interstate, I saw these billboards basically saying, get your concealed carry permit from a licensed instructor in 3 days or less. You know, show up for a one-day course, get your concealed carry permit within 72 hours, something like that. That's what Texas is like. The Texans don't want anyone else telling them what to do. That's what a lot of the USA is like outside of the big cities. And it's going to become very clear over the next few years that the USA really is at least two very different countries. There are the coastal elites, the coastal urban densely populated centers, where the Kung Flu has hit hardest and where things are really rough. Those places are low trust, low respect areas, and they're going to perform very badly in picking themselves up, dusting themselves off, and dealing with the aftermath of this crisis. The red state areas are going to do relatively well. And I think we're going to see this pattern repeated globally. That's my prediction. We're going to see the kind of the red state, or red zones, or red, I don't know, localities, principalities, states, countries, you know, whatever you want to substitute in as the term. Those areas are going to perform much better than the blue state, the blue zones. Why? Because it's a fundamental difference in psychology and political philosophy. The red zones are those in which people have faith in themselves, in their communities, in their leadership, and in God above. Those areas are going to do well. The places where those things are lacking, where the basic building blocks of nations are missing, are going to do extremely badly. That's my prediction. And given the enormous amounts of debt that the US government has racked up, the day of inevitable reckoning of the collapse of the United States as a political entity has probably been accelerated by 3 to 5 years. So previously, most of us thought it was going to happen around the 2033 time frame. That's not far away. Not at all. I reckon it's probably going to happen in about 2028. The demographic trends are getting to the point where Donaldus Triumphus Magnus may well be the last Republican president the U.S. ever elects. And he may well be the last populist president that the U.S. ever elects in its current form. The breakup of the USA into 2 or 3 different countries is, at this point, basically inevitable. The collapse of the American empire is unfolding before our eyes. The destruction of the US dollar as a currency is inevitable. It's going to happen, okay? All empires end, and all empires devolve back into homogeneous nations. That's what's happening right now. We're seeing it happen, where the red states are saying, we want to get back to work, we want to reopen, we want to go back to business. The God Emperor at the top is saying, everybody get back to work, let's reopen the economy, let's get back to work, let's make things happen again. Let's stop destroying our people and our livelihoods. But the blue state governors are saying, no, we want to hold on to our power. We like being able to boss people around. We like being able to tell people what to do. This is going to accelerate the already widening fissures between and among Americans, and it's going to become unbearable eventually. Make no mistake of that. Within the next decade, I think you're going to see secession movements really take off in the USA. And I think you're going to see a new war between the states, one that is going to be so horrific and so brutal and so bloody as to defy human comprehension. The last war between the states had 600,000 something casualties, about 10% of the US population at the time. If you look at the number of people in America right now who are foreign born or of foreign descent, it's anywhere between 47 million foreign born Americans and 100 million foreign descended Americans. 100 million people who aren't Americans in a nation of 330 million. This isn't going to end well. And it's going to end with red states tearing themselves away from blue states and blue states doing everything that they can to hold on to centralized power. And you're going to see this pattern repeated around the world. Mark my words. That is my prediction. And you guys can hold me to that. If I'm still around in 10 years, if you guys are still around in 10 years, let's come back and let's revisit this and let's see if I was right. And with that, we are pretty much out of time. So I hope you enjoyed this episode of Didactic Mind. As usual, it was a little rambling, but you know, that's typically what happens when it's just you talking to a microphone. I am Didact. Please remember to like and subscribe if you have not done so already. Make sure you stop by the blog and visit. And I will see you on the next one. This has been Didactic Mind, episode 27, Red versus Blue.